A question that bears on the last question, really, that concerns so-called drug repositioning. I wonder what your view is of things like the exenatide study, which appears to offer hope of reuse of existing drugs for Parkinson's.
Yeah. Well, that offers huge opportunity. And if you have a drug or molecule that has already been used for something in patients, has already passed all the safety work, then in fact, much of the hard work has already been done for you. So something like exenatide, or indeed the drug I showed, Ambroxol, is available and has been used in humans for a completely different indication. There's the opportunity, if we can confirm that it truly has an effect, to accelerate the development of those drugs and trials in patients, because we know they're safe. All that safety work has been done. And I think people may wonder, you know, why should these drugs that have been used for something completely different be effective in Parkinson's disease? And that's actually the benefit of traditional pharmacology, that rarely have drugs been specific, and they've often had more than one effect. And we've used them for what appears to be their most obvious effect, whilst they have other beneficial potential as well. But yes, I think the sort of off-target or primary target effect is really very good.
Yeah, I think I've got a question up here.
Yes, thank you very much for the lecture. I was diagnosed at age 37 with a work colleague aged 38. His progression has been much more rapid than mine. Very early on, I started taking coenzyme Q10, and I just saw it up on one of your slides. I was just wondering what your thoughts were in the benefits of coenzyme Q10.
Okay. Well, first of all, I would say that the patients vary greatly in terms of their progression of Parkinson's disease. So you can indeed have patients who develop young onset Parkinson's disease who progress at very different rates. So that's the first thing. The second thing I would say is that the big United States study on coenzyme Q was published, I think, just about 6 weeks ago, and it was negative. And this was using high-dose coenzyme Q10 up to 2,400 milligrams. So it was disappointing, I'm afraid, that coenzyme Q didn't show benefit. Now, of course, one has to accept that that was in several hundred patients. Not all of those patients are the same, but those that had placebo as opposed to the coenzyme Q were no different down the line. Who can say whether some patients truly benefited or not? It's not a conclusion that one can draw from the study. My position on coenzyme Q has always been, I think it was a promising option. It was certainly something that had to be looked at. I think the evidence that we have currently is that it doesn't work. And my concern slightly for patients has always been it's very expensive, at least to use at the doses that have been used in the clinical trials.
Thank you. Could I just say, linked into that, I'm sure I'm going to be asked by people about, should I be taking vitamin D, double shot espressos, and smoking 30 a day?
Well, may I combine that with a trip to Rome? Because if you go to Rome and sit in one of the piazzas, you'll get all three.
Okay. There's a question up here.
I presume alpha-synuclein is present in blood as well. And if so, does it, like prion proteins, pose a threat in blood transfusion?
Okay, well, that's a very, very, very interesting question. Yes, alpha-synuclein is present in blood. It's present in very low concentrations of blood, often difficult to identify. But it's in the blood, it's present in its normal form. And it's only in the brain, in certain circumstances, when it starts to stick together, that it might initiate that process of what we call templating. So in that sense, it's not a prion disorder. It's not an infective disorder. So in that respect, blood transfusions, there's no reason to think at present that there's any relationship to Parkinson's disease.
Thank you very much. You didn't mention in your lecture, and I wonder, it seems to be a very under-researched area, is the possibility of the involvement of microorganisms of one sort or another as possible causative agents of Parkinson's and other neurodegenerative diseases, because there have been reports, I believe, where microorganisms have been seen in histological material from deceased Parkinson patients. And I just wonder if the reason why this hasn't been more researched.
Again, a very interesting point. I think it's probably fair to say that no infective agent, virus, bacteria, etc., has been identified as a common cause of Parkinson's disease as we currently know it. Now, you'll know that there was so-called viral encephalitis at the beginning of the last century that caused a Parkinson's disease-like picture, but not one with the sort of pathology that we associate with characteristic Parkinson's disease. But what we do see in regular Parkinson's is some inflammation in the brain. And people have speculated that that inflammation may be a reaction to certain types of infection, in inverted commas. The difficulty is that the brain reacts through inflammation to all sorts of stimuli, including the collection of alpha-synuclein. So I think that the possibility that infectious agents may contribute to Parkinson's disease is still very much alive, and people do look at that. And indeed, there is a very rare fungal cause of a Parkinson-like picture that's been identified. But I think currently we haven't been able to get a clear handle on the type of infective agent that might be involved, if indeed one is involved. And we've certainly seen no infectious trail for Parkinson's disease, epidemiologically or between patients. So an area that's still being researched, but one in which we haven't clearly got a handle yet.
Okay, we have a question.